coming up on Broadway Radios. This week on Broadway, we talk about the Grapes of Wrath at Trinity Rep, the Evita National Tour, Stop Reset at Signature Theater, Sweet Smell of Success at NYU, as well as the Marvin Hamlisch induction into the NYU Hall of Fame. We also chat about Frankie James Grande and Women Are Nothing at Atlantic Theater Company, and to round it out, the Bonus Army at the Gym at Judson. Please stay tuned.
The guy's in Philly.
Not if you got word to the press of the size of the crowds that he drew. A couple of breaks and he's home, combing his hair with my comb. Sydney, my life could be mine. Sydney, our goals intertwine. What if you decided to help the way I made a choice to help you?
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Monday, September 16th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, and Masterworks Broadway, as well as many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
I also understand that you had a little talk this afternoon down at the Drama Bookshop, didn't you?
Yeah, Susan Shulman, the press agent, has written a wonderful book called Backstage Pass to Broadway, and we talked about her dealings with her many clients over the years, Zero Mostel, Lauren Bacall, George C. Scott, Yul Brynner, Ronald Reagan. Well, he wasn't a client exactly, but she did have to deal with him at one point. Even though she's a staunch Democrat, she rose to the occasion. It's a terrifically funny book. It really is. And the scope of what it is to be a press agent and what you have to do and how you have to submerge yourself and often be a hat rack when they take off their coats and hold my purse and all that kind of business while they're getting photographed. I mean, it's really a very good look into what it is to be a press agent. And I had a wonderful time reading it. And yes, we did have a nice time tonight at the Drama Bookshop with a, I can't say sold out house because nobody bought tickets, but anyway, every seat was filled, so that was nice. There was standing room only, so Susan has a lot of interest, and her loyal clients, Kathleen Chalfant and Karen Ziemba, were certainly there to cheer her on, which was really nice.
That's great. She gives a new meaning to the Reagan Democrat.
That's right.
So anyway, hey, we should try to get her on in the next couple of weeks and talk about her book, some funny stories. All right. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
All righty. So the Three Musketeers were back in force today. Let's start off with Peter was out of town last week, and he got up to Trinity Rep where he saw Grapes of Wrath. So Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Trinity is my favorite regional theater of all time because it showed me back in 1967 what regional theater was capable of. I went there to see The Grass Harp that time, a musical that was trying out, and it took almost 5 years for it to get to Broadway. And because it was, you know, Providence, Rhode Island, I thought I'd see wigs falling off heads and scenery falling over. And it really was tremendously effective, especially the orchestrations for Clay Richardson's wonderful music, which was orchestrated by the then just starting out Jonathan Tunick. So I've always had a soft spot for the company, and they always do things in a flamboyant way. For example, they wanted to do Billy Budd, and they read the famous Billy Budd play, and they thought, you know, this stinks. You know, let's do our own Billy Budd. So they did their own Billy Budd, and I will never forget. They had a guy in the company who had to get whipped, and they whipped him. You know, and it certainly sounded like they were whipping him. And you know, I remember saying to Adrian Hall, gee, you know, that was so effective. I mean, how did you make that happen? And I'm still not sure if he was kidding me when he said, well, we have a guy in the company who likes it. I have no idea. I think he was kidding. But anyway, but they always do things atypically. And so when I walked into the theater and saw a setup that was not unlike Murder ballad with a bar and tables and all that for the Grapes of Wrath, I thought, oh, this is great. You know, they just will not do anything in the conventional way. They have to find their own way of doing it. And they did it very environmentally. Audience on each side, like a football field, a bar in the center, a playing area, and even a passerelle, that wraparound thing like the Dolly had in front of the orchestra pit, that type of thing. And they played on all different levels, and you really felt like you were in a bar hearing the story there. They had a band in the corner, you know, under an elk's head and sports trophies and all that kind of stuff. And all right, you know, you might say, well, wait a minute, you know, how was the show? I mean, let's not go, what the gimmicks are great. The acting was phenomenal. And a woman named Ann Scurria, who was new to me, playing Ma Jode, was just sensational. I mean, she has such a strong face. And yes, she was careworn, and yes, she was weathered, and yet you really knew that if this woman were born in another time or place, that she would have been the CEO of a company. I mean, it was just bad luck and circumstances, because she was such a smart lady, mm-hmm. and her wisdom came through at every turn, so she was marvelous. And to watch these people so hopeful about going out to California, which is going to be the promised land, and they run into somebody coming back saying, forget it, don't even bother going, you know, and they don't believe him. But the second time they hear it, they have to believe it. And yes, the streets are not paved with gold or even oranges. And it really turns out to be very disappointing for them. And we can only hope that after it would have been nice if John Steinbeck and or Frank Galati had written a sequel where we found out the Jodes did survive and even wound up finding a way to thrive in California. That doesn't quite happen by the end of the play. But it's a very moving production, even stripped of the fact that it's environmental. But there was a lot of in-your-face stuff in the aisles and people getting really close to you, and you're really feeling the poverty and the desperation increasing as time went on. So a terrific production, and it was a great way to spend an evening after spending an afternoon at the Providence Performing Arts Center, which is a gloriously beautiful theater, one of the best I've ever seen, right up there with the Fox in St. Louis or the Ohio in Columbus. Beautiful place, seeing the very first performance of the touring company of Evita. And Michael, you'll be fascinated to learn that Josh Young plays Che, and he was in the show. He was in the show. He did the performance.
That's
yeah.
good.
Michael often mentioned the fact that he was miffed that Josh didn't do many more performances than he was supposed to when he was doing Jesus Christ Superstar on Broadway. And I don't know if this is a compliment, but I mean, Josh was so good in this part. So good as Che, one of the best I've ever seen, if not the best I've ever seen. I wonder if I'm giving him a compliment when I'm saying he turns out to be a wonderful interpreter of Andrew Lloyd Webber. I mean, maybe that's not a compliment. You know, maybe nobody wants to be that. But anyway, if he does want to be that, he's doing awfully well by it. So it's a terrific company. I will admit that one is convinced that the Argentinians are listening to the Pope and are experiencing birth control, because there aren't that many people in Argentina on this stage, I'll grant you. But aside from that, everybody is very spirited in what he's doing. And so it's a very nice tour. And if it comes your way, I do urge it, if only for Josh Young, who really is sensational.
Maybe they're not interpreting Andrew Lloyd Webber as much as they're interpreting Tim Rice.
Yeah, I suppose. Yes, that is a much more fair.
I would say that even many of us who are very, very down on Lloyd Webber's later work, many of us feel that, you know, that Superstar and Evita and Joseph are really just fine.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of room to be excellent in Evita as Che or as Evita or, you know, or as.
Yeah, frankly, as I don't know who I saw. I mean, it was a matinee, and of course they have a certain actress playing the matinee performances, but I'm not sure if it's because the first performance they had the person who's doing the nighttime performance doing it. There was no slip in the playbill, so I don't have a clue as to. I mean, obviously it's one of two people, but I mean, and I don't have the playbill in front of me. But nevertheless, whoever it was good. She was good. I mean, she wasn't, you know, phenomenal beyond belief or anything, but she did the job. It was quite fine. Yeah, it's really too bad that Lloyd Webber and Rice stopped writing together. And, I mean, it does seem, as Ethan Mordden pointed out in one of his books, that Lloyd Webber really hasn't trusted a lyricist since. You know, that he seems to do one show, maybe two, with a lyricist, and then it's over. I mean, you know, he gets rid of you as quickly as Barbara Streisand gets rid of people, you know. So, so I mean, it's too bad. Now they both have musicals coming up in London. Lloyd Webber is one on the Profumo scandal of 50 years ago, and Tim Rice is doing From Here to Eternity. So we'll see how those play out.
Well, I have not been alas, I've never been to Trinity Rep, nor have I ever been to Providence, but I know Providence, Rhode Island, as I'm sure Peter will be able to confirm, is famous among musical theater fans because, if for no other reason, that in Damn Yankees, mm-hmm. at one point, Joe and Lola are discussing, the fact that they're now both, on the outs with the devil, and Joe says to Lola, you know, what were you, meaning in your former life? And she says, I was the ugliest woman in Providence, Rhode Island.
Yes, she does. You quoted it correctly. No question.
It just gets a big laugh.
And don't forget, Providence shows up in another marvelous moment in Guys and Dolls when Adelaide tells Nathan that she's lied to her mother, that she's told him that they were married.
And
that
they
have five children. You know, right. This is a little hard to swallow because you would think the mother would want to visit or, you know, see the kids. I mean, gee, you know. But anyway, she says, but that's what people do in Rhode Island. And he says, then why is it such a small state? What a great line. Great line. So, but I'll tell you, Providence contributed more than just those two lines to musical theater. Because I'm telling you, Trinity, the memories I have and the memories I hope to have. I won't see the next 50 years, but I will try to see as many as I can of them.
Well, now, as to The Grapes of Wrath, I made a point of going to see the amazing 1940 film version because they screened it at the Walter Reed Theater at Lincoln Center.
Oh, nice.
And I had never seen it on the big screen. And it's just, if you've not seen it, I think for many, many years it was considered one of the greatest films ever made. I think you don't hear it mentioned that often now only because of, well, I don't know, I guess because it's so old or it's or maybe it's not.
Black and white.
It's just not. Yeah, I mean, because it was so immediate. I mean, it was made, I think, like, you know, still in the midst of the crisis of the Dust
Bowl. Sure,
and,
sure.
But aside from that, the performances and the script, and it's also, it was the basis of a truly, truly superb stage adaptation, which Peter alluded to earlier, that the Steppenwolf company did some years ago and then brought to Broadway with Gary Sinise as Tom Joad and Lois Smith, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And
The movie, of course, Jane Darwell won an Oscar for playing Mar Joad.
Yeah.
And there's that marvelous scene which you often see on Turner Classic Movies when they do the panoply of great scenes.
Yes.
When she's putting on the earrings, you know, and she's thinking of herself in very feminine terms, which is something she hasn't allowed her to do. Now, that doesn't happen in this version of the play. It may have, by the way, in the original Steppenwolf. I don't remember. But what is interesting here is that she goes wading in the water. And there's no water. I mean, she mimes it. But the point is, when she gets in that water, the years melt away and she's a young girl again. And it's such a wonderful transition. This Anne Scurria, who I didn't know, is really, really sensational in the part.
There's also, I don't know if you got to see it, Peter, but there's what I think is a beautiful opera of Grapes of Wrath by Ricky Ian Gordon, which I saw not in a full production, but they did a concert version of it at Carnegie Hall. And the only real problem with that opera is that it's if you do it uncut, it's tremendously long. Because he there's so much in much in that novel and that, you know, that it's hard to cut anything because it's all so incredibly powerful and moving.
Mm-hmm.
But on this occasion, they did an edited version of it and it was really quite something. It was Victoria Clark was Maggio.
Oh.
Stephen Pasquale was in the cast, and then there was some, you know, legit, you know, opera people. So my point being that it's has provided amazing fodder for film and stage and operatic treatment, and it's just one of the true immortal classic works, I think, of American.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah,
quintessentially American.
Yeah,
no question about that.
So, Peter, quickly on Evita before we move on, I was just wondering, would you ever think that maybe Tracy Bennett could do it?
Sure. I think Tracy Bennett could do anything.
All right. Michael? Okay.
Well, I have.
Michael, you should just stop and reset, shouldn't you?
I should stop and reset at this point, yes.
That's right. So Michael got a chance to see Stop, Reset at the Signature Theater. So Michael, tell us about that.
Well, not too many seasons ago, the playwright of this play, Regina Taylor, had a show on Broadway called Drowning Crow, which was her adaptation of Chekhov's The Seagull, and a very free adaptation, but an adaptation nonetheless. And that show, unfortunately, was infamous for the amount of people who were literally running for the exits at the intermission. It was, I'm sorry to say, quite a fiasco in both, I guess, critical reception, audience reception, and I assume at the box office, although it was done by, I think it was Manhattan Theater Club, so they had something of a cushion there, I guess, because it is a subscription house. So I was trepidatious about seeing Stop, Reset, but I wanted to see, you know, what, if anything, maybe Miss Taylor had learned about the art of playwriting. And I guess I can report that the chief thing she learned is not to have an intermission. Because there was none in this play, and had there been, I think there would have been maybe not quite so frantic an attempt at exiting. But I will say, I haven't seen and heard this very often. At the end of the show, I mean, I think that even when you see shows that are really not good, that you much of the time you will get quite vociferous applause from the audience if we're talking about Broadway or a major off-Broadway, because I think people are just conditioned to do it. They think it would be terribly impolite not to do it. But in this case, when the lights went down at the end of the play, there was very, very, very tepid applause. I got the impression that maybe half the audience was not applauding at all. And then only when the lights came up and the actors took their bows, then the applause picked up quite a bit. In which I think, Peter, I think you've addressed this issue. How do you indicate that you hated the play, but you really appreciate the actors? And I guess that's the way to do it, because, you know,
it is
short of booing, you know, which I think very few of us can really bring ourselves to do. I think that's the best way to do it. And in this case, it seemed very clear to me that was the situation, that a great many people in the audience at Signature really, really disliked the play, but appreciated the actors. And the sad thing is that it's a very, very interesting subject. She's dealing here with what's called the Alexander Ames Chicago Black Book Publishers. And it's set in the offices of this publishing company in the present time. And it deals with all kinds of issues that publishing companies are facing nowadays, whether, you know, black or not, you know, just the technology and ebooks and, you know, how to remain relevant and things like that, and things that are of tremendous interest to me personally. And there were moments when they really, you know, there were sections that were really very, very interesting and very gripping, like when they're talking about how they might have to move to another town, leave Chicago, and then one of the workers says, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't be specifically black anymore, and so the owner says something like, well, you know, what about our name? You know, you've just taken two things out. You've taken out Chicago, you've taken out black. You know, what's left? I don't know. I mean, aside from everything else, this is one of those plays where there are many moments that seem like they're quite realistic, you know, and the kind of dialogue and things that could happen in an actual office environment. But then all of a sudden there's, you know, it goes into like these surreal fantasy sequences, most of which involve one of the central characters is this character named Jay. That's just the letter J, played by Ismael Cruz Cordova, and he's the janitor of the company. But he winds up being sort of forming this bond with the owner. Alexander Ames, played by Carl Lumbly, and then they and it seems like he's going to be taken on as like one of the major high mucky mucks of the company. And so but anyway, there were all these fantasy sequences involving him, and I just felt that the transitions were very, very confusing, and there was a lot of dialogue that was very pretentious, and the whole thing really, really did not hang together. So I'm sorry that I didn't like it more, because I do think that the subject matter was extremely interesting.
All right, so perhaps they didn't have the sweet smell of success that they had down at NYU. Peter got down to see Sweet Smell of Success, and it was a double header, wasn't it, that night?
Well, but actually, this was a celebration of Marvin Hamlisch. In fact, he was supposed to be there. They had planned some time ago that he would be inducted into the NYU Hall of Fame, and I know that he would love to have been there, but unfortunately he did die. So his widow, Terry, was there and gave a very heartfelt speech. And it was really quite nice to see this happen, because after all, this is a significant man, Tony. Oscar, Emmy, all of them, really, Pulitzer Prize, Grammy, everything, you know. So he was really something. And so NYU appreciated that. Now, the thing was, some time ago, about 2 years ago, a marvelous director named John Simpkins staged The Sweet Smell of Success with NYU students. And he had dealt with Marvin Hamlisch at the time about what to do. They inserted some things that were dropped from the Broadway production, including the opening number. They used the original lyric for the opening number, which didn't make it to Broadway. And the set was very simple, but it worked so well. It was simply backdrops of newspaper headlines. And the set on Broadway, I thought, was one of the most ugly atrocities in the history of mankind. So there was that was too. But John Simpkins, really a great director. He really kept it moving. It was so marvelous. I will admit, and this, of course, is partly because I'm getting older, that the kids looked awfully young to be playing these hard-bitten types that Sweet Smell of Success demands, especially J.J. Hunsicker, the gossip columnist who's a terror and who everybody fears. And one of the marvelous things about Sweet Smell of Success that was not in the original novella, not in the movie, is that here the person who's trying to curry up to him more than anybody else is named Sidney Falcone. Mm. And in the movie, he's Sidney Falco, and in the book, he's Sidney Falco. But what they did here, what John Guare did, was have Hunsicker say to him, nah, you shouldn't be Falcone. You should be Falco, because there's Monroe and there's Harlow and there's Brando. You should be Falco. And that's a marvelous thing, because, wow, when a guy takes the liberty of saying, I am going to change your name, and the guy says, okay, you know, because he wants to get on his good side. I mean, that's really something. I mean, that when you start playing around with names, the most basic things we all have, I mean, that is really something. So a lot of smart things to Sweet Smell of Success, and the score, I think, is truly beautiful. That noir music is really right. A song called I Cannot Hear the City really, really captures that black and white New York arts and set decoration movie that we know from the 50s. I mean, there's something about the music that really reflects that. You almost feel the nighttime of New York and the rain that has just finished pouring and the streets are wet. I mean, that has really captured the music, and that's one of the things that made Marvin Hamlisch great. So I think it's a phenomenal, phenomenal score. Always have. And I'll tell you, I got the demo about 2 years before the show was produced, and I'm telling you, it was a two-disc set, and it took me about, seriously, 3 months to get through the first one, because I kept on playing repeat and so on and so forth. It really was a long time before I got to the second disc, you know. So I really think it's marvelous material, and the kids really did well by it. I do think we have some stars in the making there. So God love them all, and especially John Sim. Oh, and a choreographer named M.K. Lawson, who terrific work indeed. So really a top-notch presentation. And I do hope Marvin Hamlisch was able to see it from some
other place.
Yeah, right. So I hope he was, because he would be very pleased at how well it held up from the production of 2 years ago. Some of the kids were the same. They brought them back. And I really do admire this musical. And I will never forget in the Tony Room that year that John Lithgow had won for Best Actor. And he was answering our questions and so on and so on. And he said, well, let me get downstairs and see if we're going to win Best Musical. And there was such a quiet in the room, because everybody knew, including him, that they weren't going to win Best Musical. I mean, the reviews are really poisonous, because this is another example, as Tommy Toon says, when you aim for a 10 and you get an 8, you know, they kill you. When you aim for a 2 and you get a 2, oh, that is just, oh, it's wonderful. You know, so junk gets praised while the ambitious stuff does not, because it doesn't quite hit all the marks. And I will admit that the original production of Sweet Smell of Success had its flaws. I didn't think the staging was quite right for it at all. And and here, John Simpson really solved a lot of problems.
Well, I think they had, I think they had the wrong director on Broadway. And my chief memory of seeing the original production was I was uncomfortable with the way the chorus was used. But it's interesting that you mentioned that the lyrics to the opening number were changed, because now do you mean got to get in the papers? Is that the point?
Yes. Got to get in the papers. The lyric that wound up Broadway originally was someone started a rumor. So it was that type of thing. The stress was on that, about rumors and rumor mongering and how rumors destroy lives and that type of thing. And very, very effective. Yeah. So I hope people wind up doing this. You know, really, I got a very nice email from a reader during that period of time saying I wasn't going to go, and somehow you just convinced me that I should go, and I'm so glad I did. And so I sold one ticket. Okay, no wonder they closed. But I mean, my point is that I just wonder how many other people would have really enjoyed it if they gave it a chance. Enjoy may be a very strange word to use with this, because this is a bitter door show. But, you know, so many people say to me, oh, I like dark musicals. Well, here's your chance. You know, I mean, by all means, this people seem to say that more than anything else. I mean, whenever you hear of a director taking on a classic musical, don't you always say, well, we're going to darken it? Have you ever heard anybody say about any musical, well, we're going to lighten it? You know, I mean, never. So if we're in these dark times of musicals, well, here's a really good dark one. So I hope that people consider producing it in their community theaters and give it a nice renaissance. There's a lot of good stuff.
I didn't get to see this most recent one, but I got to see the NYU of 2 years ago, and it really was quite something, and it was quite a hit, quite a hit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that's why they did it again, even though not with all the same people. And we should give a nod to, I think, to Craig Carnelia, who might have turned out to be, a very good, wonderful, more of a regular partner for Hamlisch, who didn't always have necessarily the best, highest quality lyricists working with him. But I think that they might have, although maybe they wouldn't have, because unfortunately, as you mentioned, Peter, the show was not well received. So maybe that, I have no idea.
Well, I will say this, a couple of years ago after the NYU presentation, but a week later, I ran into Craig Carnelia and said, hey, did you see that Sweet Smell of Success? It was terrific. He said, the show broke my heart so much I couldn't even go. And he wasn't there the other night either. You know what I mean? So not at the party beforehand. You know,
that's
so,
too bad. That's too bad.
Yeah, it really is. He's a wonderful, wonderful songwriter.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not just lyrics, when he writes melodies too. His songs for Working are exquisite. And his songs for Is Their Life After High School. I urge people to get that CD, because the quality of the work is truly, truly wonderful. I mean, just a quick example. The Things I Learned in High School, he points out, I learned a lot of things that now are not even so. And it's true, did we all? I mean, you know, I mean, a lot of people learned there were 48 states, you know. Well, there aren't, you know, I mean, there's more now, you know, but you had to learn at one time there were 48 states. So so anyway, very, very clever work.
That other great line, I learned that something equals pie.
You know, I was just going to bring that one up, too. Yes. Yes, indeed, you know, because we don't need in our lives to know what pie equals. It doesn't come up in anything I'm doing, I'll tell you. Anyway.
Well, I love pie.
I love pie too.
Apple pie, cherry pie. Mm. So, Michael, when you went down to the Laurie Beachman Theater, did you have pie when you saw Frankie James LeGrand? Frankie James Grand.
Frankie James Grande. Did a wonderful show at the Laurie Beachman. And so much fun. I'm sure he wrote it all himself too. He's a very creative person.
It's quite the Renaissance man, isn't it?
Yeah, one of these like geniuses who can really seemingly do anything, and I don't know how they find the time to do it, but somehow they do. One of his first big thing was he was in the chorus of Mamma Mia, but then he won the first Broadway beauty pageant at the time when it was called Mr. Broadway. The very first winner, it was Frankie James Grande. And then he recently has been getting into producing. One of his credits was The Born Yesterday with Nina Arianda, and there are several others. That's just the one that leaps to mind. But then also he talked about how he had gone to Africa to do humanitarian work. I'm so amazed and impressed by people like that who not only have the talent in various areas, but somehow, you know, can find the time to express it. So I really enjoyed seeing him just be fun and silly for an hour and 15 minutes or whatever it was. And I also wanted to mention the Laurie Beachman Theater. We talk about venues, cabaret venues and club venues, and that's another one that I don't think I've mentioned a lot lately. But it's really a wonderful venue in the basement of the West Bank Cafe on 42nd Street, just west of 9th Avenue, named after one of the great musical theater stars, Laurie Beachman, who died all too young from cancer. But they have really great shows, and they have very smart shows. And also, it's a place where the sight lines are excellent. And you can't say that about a lot of cabaret venues. It's a roomy room. You don't ever feel like you're really scrunched into to the person next to you in the audience. And the stage is raised high enough so that you can see well, even if you have heads in front of you. And they have an excellent sound system. So keep that place on your radar, along with Birdland and 54 Below and all of these other wonderful places that have talent like this doing really, really great stuff.
Michael, I forgot to ask you before we started. Did you get that article I sent you on Feinstein's apartment?
Oh yeah, yes, I read it just today. I guess it came out. Several days ago?
Yeah,
yeah.
Michael Feinstein's apartment is on the market for $17 million or something.
Apparently, you're saying apartment. He put two townhouses together into one, and the pictures are absolutely mind-boggling.
I've been there. It's everything that you would imagine from those pictures, believe me.
But the interesting part about, I mean, aside from being a $17 million place in New York City, the taxes, $57,000 a year in taxes alone, was that it was interesting that he and his partner are selling their apartment, but yet we were talking to them a few weeks ago, their PR people, and said that they are going to be reopening a room here in New York. So I wonder why they would kind of downsize their life here in New York.
Well, I'm sure he has places to crash.
Yeah, and the Plaza, you know.
Maybe he's decided to become a customer and he needs that money for the cover charges.
I see. It It's pretty pricey to go to those places.
Oh, absolutely. I remember when I was at a Theater World Awards, which always takes place on a Monday, in Campton Hampton Calloway was appearing that weekend, that upcoming weekend at Feinstein's. And I said, and I hope we're giving you enough notice to mortgage your homes and sell your children so you can afford to go this weekend. So it's really quite a pretty penny.
Well, also someone on a blog or somewhere commented, after reading the article about the sale of this double townhouse, for that price, somebody said, well, I guess it must pay pretty well to be a cabaret star and a song archivist. But, Michael Feinstein, God love him, has become really, an icon in both of those areas. More power to him.
Absolutely. He made it happen. It's easy to jump on a rock band. Well, not easy. But, I mean, my point is, in a world that's increasingly consumed by rock, look at what he's done in totally avoiding rock music and really making a niche and a name for himself. It's pretty impressive.
Right, and I for one am thrilled that someone can do that and make that much money. It's nice to know. I mean, even if he's maybe one of very few people, it's still nice to know that those things he does on TV are incredible. These where he goes around and meets these other archivists and goes to see these people who have record collections from the dawn of recorded sound in every possible format, cylinders and wire recordings, and it does my heart good.
I agree. He does have great respect for the past, and that also means the technology of the past. I was talking to a friend whose son was curling his lip at those little silver things you people used to use to play music, he would say condescendingly, because of course it's all Spotify with him now, I wish this young man who's married, I wish his wife were there, because I would love to say to her, if I were you, I'd be worried. I mean, obviously he's the type of person who has no respect for the past, and I wonder if he'll trade you in the way he will trade in a CD for Spotify. So I still hope that one day I'll be able to say that to him.
Oh my God.
Well, for him,
let the punishment fit the crime.
Yes.
For him, maybe it's women or nothing.
Got it.
So Peter got a chance to see Women or Nothing down at the Atlantic Theater Company. Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Ethan Coen's play, quite a crazy what it is, with a million holes in it. Good Lord. All right, so we have a lesbian couple, and they want to have a child. But they don't want to do it with a turkey baster type situation. They want a real man there. It's never convincingly explained why it has to be that way. But anyway, what they're going to do is have, I don't remember the character's name. Let's call them A and B for the sake of this conversation. So A works with a nice young man who has a daughter from an ex-wife, and A has met the daughter and thinks she's just the sun and the moon. So obviously this guy has good genes, and she would love to have a child that would be as lovely as this little girl. So so she wants him to be the sperm donor. However, A is not able to have a child herself. That's medically proven. So everything falls on B. And so she wants her lesbian lover to go to bed with this guy. And they've tricked him. He's going to come over ostensibly to talk to A. And suddenly she's been called out of town. And that leaves him with B. And she's going to get him drunk, and she's going to take him to bed. She's going to pretend she's the neighbor from next door. And why she's in the apartment is very strange to me. And anyway, she does successfully take him to bed. And I don't know why, under those circumstances, she wouldn't say, let's go to my apartment, which of course she doesn't have, but she's supposed to be the neighbor down the hall. So, I mean, that's very strange to me too. So, the next morning, her mother shows up at the apartment. The mother is very, very well drawn, and it's very nicely played by Deborah Rush, who may be doing a Madeleine Kahn imitation. It's I'll tell you, if they do the Madeleine Kahn story, she's got to play the part. I mean, it's amazing how much she is like her in this. And here's a mother who's fully at home with her daughter's lesbianism. It's no problem at all. She loves her daughter-in-law, so to speak, A. And And when the guy comes out, you know, I mean, she's shocked, of course, that her daughter has been cheating on A, and for that matter, has been doing it with a guy. Why the guy isn't saying, what is your mother doing here? You know, why would she come to this apartment, given that you live down the hall? I mean, you know, at least bring up these questions and you have a flimsy excuse. Well, I told her I'd be here. She called me on my cell phone. You know, but I mean, it's just bizarre that there were so many holes in this thing. It does have a quite impressive, quirky surprise ending, which I won't give away. And Ethan Coen is such a marvelous writer, so the characterizations are really quite good. Aside from these gaping holes, it's really quite a good thing. And you know, I gotta give an amazing thing at the Atlantic Theater Company. They did not have to do this, and they did something with the set that must have cost a fortune, because it's established that B is a concert pianist, and quite a successful one. She really, really works. She's around the country. She's flown everywhere. She stays in great hotels, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So they actually have just a long, long ceiling covering a third of the set. And atop that is a piano. And that's her piano. She never goes up there. I mean, this is one of those spiral staircases, goes up to the second level. She never goes up there. That piano is there. Just to indicate and establish that she's a classical pianist. And they had to build this ceiling that could hold a piano. I mean, it's astonishing. Wow. They went for that detail, you know, that they really felt it was worth it to do that detail. Now, who knows? Maybe originally she did go up and play the piano. Maybe that's why it's there. That's easier to believe that they would just do it. But I was so amazed that that money was spent on what had to be a considerable amount. Now, you know, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's the piano weighs, you know, 14 pounds because they've gutted it, or maybe it's just the facade of a piano. I don't know. But still, you know, the attention to detail is very impressive, that they actually worked that hard to create that image, that to establish that she really is a serious pianist. So very nicely done. Good performances all around. Deborah Rush, though, it gives one of those performances that when she exits, she gets a hand. So Women Are Nothing, it's something. It's something. But there are times when there is nothing offered an explanation where there certainly should be.
You know, you've prompted me to mention, I should mention that the set for Stop Reset was also extraordinary by Neil Patel, or Patel, P-A-T-E-L. Yeah. And also, not just the set, but the way it worked with the lighting by Lapchi Chili, and the projection design by Sean Sagadi. Boy, I'm getting a pronunciation workout. But yeah, and this is at the Signature, where, if I'm correct, isn't it true that all shows there are $20 tickets?
I think 25.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's an, you know.
These days, that's a deal. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. Very impressive.
So after that, Peter made a left-hand turn and went down to the gym at Judson and saw the Bonus Army. So you want to tell us quickly about the Bonus?
Yeah, Al Carmine's show that isn't well-known. I mean, while many of his shows aren't well-known, Joan, you should pardon the expression, the faggot. That's what he wrote. I didn't call it that. In Circles, Peace. These were not famous off-Broadway musicals, but they were famous enough to get cast albums. Not on major labels, no, but though Promenade did. It was an RCA Victor release. That's perhaps his best-known show. In fact, the Promenade Theater was named because the show going in there was Promenade. I mean, many may not remember the Promenade Theater that was on Upper Broadway in the 70s, but for many years it was a prime off-Broadway house. Anyway, Bonus Army came out in 76, and I just happened to be in town in 76. I was still living in Boston, but having just seen Joan in Boston, which I think is really a terrific show, I couldn't wait to see Bonus Army. And I went, and I was terribly disappointed in 1976 because I thought it was pretty dull and awfully restaged. Well, Russell Trays came in, did a very different type of staging. It's like Circle in the Square. We're all around the action, so on and so forth. And I don't know, it made such a difference. I don't know, maybe too, you know, the fact that we've been through so much inferior musical theater over the last 35 years, whatever it is, that this suddenly seemed better. But the melodies were quite strong, and it was very well performed. I think they may have a few performances left, so I really recommend getting down to that Judson Gym and seeing it. This is about the fact that veterans from the war were promised money by the government, and now they're having a tough time getting their bonus, and they're going to protest. And this is one of the first real serious protests that we had in American history, not including, of course, the American Revolution, which was certainly a bigger protest. But you get my point that protests about money certainly weren't everyday occurrences then, but these guys decided they were going to do it. So you get to know the personalities involved, and very, very effective with quirky music. Al Carmine's was incapable of writing anything else. He had a distinctive sound, and in a way, it almost seems like, you know, he wrote down whatever came to his head at that moment and left it alone. But there is a sense of melody in this one that's stronger than many of them. So I can easily recommend Bonus Army.
All right. So in the news this week, we have some more recent news. I hesitate to ever call anything breaking news, that the Bronx Bombers is delaying its first off-Broadway preview, that Joe Pantoliano has left the production. So what do you think about that?
Well, I guess he must have been ashamed to be associated with the Yankees after what happened this weekend with the Red Sox. That must be it.
I tell you, we might as well even just fold up Yankee Stadium.
Well, this year anyway, but that's another story. I don't know this actor, or do I? I mean, is this like a Sopranos guy or something like that? Where did he come from? Has he done theater? The name doesn't mean anything to me.
Well, he's, I think he's...
Was he a big movie star?
He was in The Sopranos, wasn't he?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
The name like that, you almost like are assured you'd get into the
Joey Pants, you know.
Yeah.
That's his nom.
So he's playing Yogi Berra.
Yeah, he was Ralph Cifaretto on The Sopranos.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He was in The Matrix. He's a movie star.
Yeah.
And from Hoboken, so a movie star from Hoboken, he had to have been in Sopranos.
Got it. Interestingly enough, in terms of playing Yogi Berra, you know, I remember one time I had to call Yogi Berra for a quote. His wife answered the phone. I said,
"My God,
may I speak to Lawrence?" You know, because that's his real name. You know, and you could see she was surprised somebody would call. Who calls it us for Lawrence? You know, but Lawrence isn't here at the moment. She said, "You know, who is this?" You know, so anyway, his wife, by the way, was a big patron of the arts in New Jersey, especially with Luna Stage, a company in Montclair. And I'll never forget. This is the most bizarre thing. Olympia Dukakis was playing King Lear. I mean that.
Okay.
I mean, really, what do Olympia Dukakis, King Lear, and Yogi Berra have in common? Yogi was in the audience, you know, and I was hoping he'd fall asleep, and I was going to nudge him and say, "It ain't over till it's over," you know. But that didn't happen. You know, he stayed awake, God love him, and watched Olympia Dukakis play King Lear. So Yogi's certainly a colorful character, and I imagine the playwright is going to make the most of his malapropisms and, you know, all the famous quotations. One that comes to mind immediately is when he ordered a pizza in a restaurant, and the woman said, "Should I cut it into 6 slices or 8 slices? And he said, "Oh, 6, I could never eat 8. So a lot of stories like that, so that may very well come up. But it's interesting how many of these actors are playing different Yankees. I mean, like the one who's playing, I think Mickey Mantle is playing Thurman Munson, that type of thing. You know, there's a lot of doubling going on. So we're really going to get apparently a history of the glory days, and that's going to be pretty impressive for those of us who care about baseball. So.
Well, what's interesting, among other things, the announcement of the change just came through today, and the show was to have started previews tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it's said right there in the press release that Mr. Pantoliano was leaving for artistic differences. And by the way, he's being replaced by Richard Topol.
Good actor.
Very good actor. And it's really interesting because the producers behind this, this whole thing basically are Fran Kermser and Tony Ponturo, and their first show was on Broadway at Circle in the Square, and it was Lombardi, which I thoroughly enjoyed. You know, I really don't have anything negative to say about it. It had an amazing performance by Judith Light, Tony winning performance, right?
Oh, I don't think she won a Tony, but she may have. But I know she's won two in a row, but I don't think that was one of them.
Okay, well, maybe I'm losing track because she works constantly.
Sure, I'm sure, sure.
I
Lauria was very good, too.
Yeah, Dan Lauria. And so I thoroughly enjoyed it. Then they did... Magic Bird.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which was, and by the way, and was also by Eric Simonson, the playwright, and that did not go over as well because I didn't think it was as anywhere near as good a play. But now this one, Bronx Bombers, is not, I think it was originally announced for Broadway, but as it turns out, it's being produced, co-produced by Primary Stages, but it's not even being produced at Primary Stages Theater. It's being produced at the Duke on 42nd Street, which is, I think, considerably smaller in terms of seating. So I guess that these producers maybe have lowered their sights a little bit, and maybe they're having more trouble in the wake of Magic Bird, which, as I say, really didn't go over that well. But and in this case, what's also interesting is that the first two shows were directed by Thomas Kail, who really made his mark with In the Heights, but this one is written and directed by Eric Simonson. So although it does have several people who have worked with these people before, Keith Nobbs, who was so terrific in Lombardi, is in it. So is Bill Dawes, and I think maybe one or two other people. So I guess they like to work with the same people when they feel it's working, and it's. I mean, I am curious about this, among other things, as Peter said, exactly how much of the Yankees history are they going to try to encompass? I seem to remember reading that it's maybe set in two separate time periods.
Yeah, that's the casting suggests that, given the people that are in it. There's an irony, of course, that it's playing the Duke, because we think of Duke Snyder, who was a Brooklyn Dodger, you know, so there's even a song that involves Mickey and the Duke, you know, meaning Mickey Mantle, a baseball song with a ton of imperfect rhymes, but that's another story. And so there's a little irony there that the Duke should be playing host to the Bronx Bombers show. And yet, you know, it's a nice little space. It really is, you know, so.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm interested in going.
I mean, it's not that little, but but there are people playing real icons in this. I mean, C.J. Wilson is playing Babe Ruth. Mm-hmm. Keith Nobbs is playing Billy Martin. Mm-hmm. Christopher Jackson from In the Heights is playing Derek Jeter. Chris Henry Coffey is playing Joe DiMaggio. And John Wernke is playing Lou Gehrig.
Yeah, they could get Derek Jeter himself now because he's out for the season.
He
so
is.
They should try him. Yeah, they should try
and A-Rod's out for the season too as well. So
he may be out for more than that, but that's another story. Okay,
yeah, absolutely. So every week I try to mention Jennifer Ashley Tepper.
Great lady.
She posted something very funny and insightful the other day on Facebook, and I thought I'd share it. It says, only 1 week and one day until Christmas. And, of course, she was talking about the Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS flea market, which is Christmas, as she says, for Broadway fans. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to mention that it is coming up. And as we mentioned last week or the week before, that you should get out and go see it if you can. I have a link to all the information in the show notes if you want to get there. And also, Michael...
Well, let me say, even if you don't have a dime, you know, and you have no disposable income to spend on memorabilia, go anyway. You're with the people who care about what you care about. You rub elbows with them. You meet people. You meet nice people. You might start friendships that'll last a lifetime. It really is a great place for... We know that everybody who's there is very much into theater, and that doesn't happen every day of the week, so you should take advantage of it. I hope the weather's good.
Yeah. Absolutely. And Michael and I were talking last week about Broadway on Broadway. Mm. And
James went to the website of the Broadway League, and all it said was no Broadway on Broadway this year. Something, and then it said something like, stay tuned for further details. And it turns out, and a couple of days later, that the further details were that concert, which normally takes place in Times Square, is this year going to be held, let's see, at the Brook, an equivalent concert called Broadway on the Hudson, a free concert, is going to be held at the Brookfield Place Waterfront Plaza at 220 Vesey Street, way downtown. So I'm not sure exactly why they moved it, although we were discussing earlier, it might have something to do with the fact that there is quite extensive construction in Times Square at the moment, relative to continuing to turn the area into more of a pedestrian mall. Broadway basically has been closed between 42nd and like 48th Street, or maybe even a little further up, and 7th Avenue is still open to traffic, but Broadway is now a pedestrian mall for all of that space. And I guess they're doing further work in terms of maybe putting in more amenities and benches. But then I think also there's water main work going on around there. So it's not maybe that's the only reason why they decided, well, we really shouldn't do it here this year. And they're doing it downtown. But it's going to be on Friday, September 27th from 12:30 to 2 p.m. Is that right? A Friday?
Yeah, Friday. That's strange. Well, yeah, I'm looking at that too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Gee, I wonder why they didn't do it on a Saturday or a Sunday. But anyway, well, that's when it is. And it's performers from they're promising participating shows: Annie, Chicago, First Date, Newsies, Phantom of the Opera, Pippin, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, Rock of Ages, and Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
All righty. So there's actually a link to that in the show notes as well. So if you're interested in going down there and seeing it, you can find all that stuff there. Last thing we want to talk about today is there was news out of Spider-Man about the replacement of Peter Parker, but you can hear about that lots of places. One of the two things that I wanted to bring up were from two Broadway insiders. Adam Pascal posted this on his Facebook page. He said, "This drives me nuts about Broadway. I'm happy for the kid who got the part, but why announce a nationwide casting call for the new Spider-Man when you just end up giving the part to the alternate understudy? Why put him and every hopeful guy who auditioned through your bullshit? Once again, shame on you." And I thought that was very interesting of Adam to point that out. And I thought that too. We had all these press releases, nationwide search and things in Los Angeles and Chicago and all around the nation looking for the guy who's been at the theater 8 times a week already. And that was very interested. And Fred Barton, who is
I love Fred.
A composer, lyricist, and producer, and various other different things within the Broadway sphere. He wrote, "While the producers were all chatty about their latest cannon fodder boy, they continue a total media and backstage blackout on what happened that night to dancer Daniel Curry, the prognosis for his lost foot and ruined life, and what was done to prevent the reoccurrence, and what current safety standard is for Broadway performers in their $1 million a week death trap." And so it's interesting to see such prominent people in the industry stepping out on social media to talk about, you know, more or less how they're producing this show. And I think it's a very positive step, because we, in the midst of all these avalanche of press releases and rewritten press releases on various websites, we haven't talked about Daniel Curry and what's happening with him, and And what is, you know, how does he continue on in his art when he's had such a tremendous damage to his leg? So
I know, just recently somebody said that to me. They said something like, why are we not reading any follow-up? I mean, you might at least expect the Times. It seems like Patrick Healy was really on it. I don't know if everyone is just refusing to say anything. That's all I can assume. And then I read something somewhere that said something like people weren't authorized to speak by the production, but including, I think they said that he wasn't authorized to speak by the production. So I don't know. I guess maybe that's all tied up in whatever settlement or lawsuit. Yeah. I'm not even sure if he, from what Fred wrote, it seems to indicate that he actually lost the foot. Do we know?
I don't know. I don't know at all, but it's, it's, you know, Fred is a very, very smart person, and I don't think that he would go out and say something like that if he didn't know something. But we'll have to check it out and see.
Well, he could. I mean, you know, if he lost complete use of it, it's almost like losing it. So,
sure.
But that, what a horrible thing. And I wish that, I wish someone would. I would make the call myself, but nobody's going to tell me anything. You know, and I have to say that I. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure that I'm really that happy with the way the press agents are dealing with that, even though I'm sure they have their own marching orders. But I don't see how you can just not let people know what is going on when somebody is that grievously injured.
Absolutely. All right. So let's wrap up for the evening. Michael, you're going to go see an opera at BAM tomorrow?
Yes, I'm seeing Anna Nicole, the opera, which has some Broadway people in it, including the great Mary Testa and the great James Barber. I'm really curious about it because I haven't read a lot about it. I'm not sure. I actually ran into James. Did I mention this on the subway a few weeks ago? I was going to Brooklyn to meet a friend, and I said, "What are you doing now?" Because I didn't know, and he said, "I'm doing that," and he pointed to a poster that was on the subway wall, and it was this poster for Anna Nicole. And I said, "Oh," I said, "I'm not that knowledgeable about it. I knew it was coming, but I said, "What type of music is it? Is it like anything like traditional opera music?" And he said, "It's really a mix, and it's really something." And he said, he said something about how after the first rehearsal, Mary Testa was like, "Oh my God, this is amazing." So I'm very curious. It's the opening, so I will report back.
Peter, what have you got on the agenda coming up?
Well, I'm going to see Stop Reset, even though Michael didn't like it. I'm going to do that. I'm out on Thursday, and I'm going to be at the Drama League at 32 Avenue of the Americas doing a thing about my book, Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks, for the Drama League. So I'm really looking forward to that. Then The Murder of Venus, which sounds like a very interesting play about... a transsexual, and then the George Kelly play at the Mint. I'm looking forward to seeing on Saturday afternoon. So Natural Affection by William Inge this week too. Arguendo at the Pap. You know, so there's a lot going on. You know, and it's starting again, and it's great. It's so nice to be back home where I belong.
We have a lot of openings coming up, and a lot of Romeo and Juliet's.
Yes, right.
Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, we do.
All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can also listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. And that way, it'll be automatically streamed to you when we do have a new show. Broadway World is kind enough to play us on their radio station Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And if you go to BroadwayRadio.com, there's links to some of the things we've talked about today. That way you can find them pretty easily, as well as contact information for Peter, Michael, and me. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Adios.
Night.